The field turns for home.
They're at the top of the stretch.
Top of the stretch.
They're into the stretch.
And here they come into the final furlong.
Final furlong.
Into the final furlong.
They go inside the final furlong.
This is the final furlong on HRRN Live.
HRRN Live.
It's Trainer Talk Wednesday, presented by Bullet Train.
Bullet Train.
Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station. Now, here's Mike Pena and Jude Feld.
Well, good afternoon once again, everybody. Welcome to Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch. Jude Feld, you know him, the pontiff of the Pick Four, ready to roll for the next hour. We do welcome everybody just joining us coast to coast on Sirius Channel 93. And for those of you who have been with us on XM 209 for our live racing coverage for the past 3 hours, welcome back to the program. Looking forward to this next hour here on Trainer Talk. Always a lot of fun to visit with trainers and hear their stories. And we're going to start off with a good one here this afternoon. Trainer Pete Miller, who has conditioned so many winners throughout his career, 382 to be exact. His runners have earned more than $14 million. The native of Los Angeles, California, still a resident of Southern California. And he's nice enough to join us here now. Pete, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, happy to have you on board, and can't wait to hear your story. I know that my co-host here has a thing or two to do with it.
Yep, Jude's a big part of my story, and Jude knows my story all too well. But I'm glad to share it with everyone else.
Well, let's walk back to the beginning and talk about how you got hooked on horse racing before you even got into the sport in terms of working with it.
Well, you know, my stepfather, Gary Hallman, who raced for 30 years under Winning Ways Stables, he introduced me to the game when I was 8 years old, when he met my mom. And, you know, I fell in love with it immediately. And, you know, I just tagged along with him every weekend to the races. And this was in the heyday when there was, you know, 30, 40,000 every weekend. And that's kind of where I got my start, was just coming to the races as a fan, and my dad and my mom owned horses, and I got hooked.
You told a great story at Gary's memorial service the other day about missing school and coming out and playing pick three, I think it was. And you like so many kids on the racetrack, you knew how to read the form and gamble long before you were doing math problems, probably.
Yeah, no, if I'd have spent as much time on my studies as I did on the racing form, I'd probably be a doctor or a lawyer. But but I was not interested in that. And, you know, the horses were my love, and I wanted to be a jockey initially, and there was a jockey school out in Castaic, California at the time. This is 1976. And they put me in school there. And so I went out and learned to ride when I was 10, and wanted to be a jockey. And by the time I was 15, I was already about 120 pounds. So it looked like being a jockey was going to be a tough road to hoe. So I figured the next best thing was to be a trainer. And from there, I got jobs, you know, with my dad's trainers. We had Jude Feld was one of our early trainers. And so I worked with Jude. I worked with some guys that no one out there will probably have ever heard of unless they're old timers, a guy named Joe Manzi. Guy named Hal King, and then I went to work for Mike Mitchell, and these were all kind of summer jobs that I held during Del Mar. And when I graduated from high school, the next day I went to Hollywood Park, and I got lucky enough to get a job with the master, Charlie Whittingham.
What do you remember about that first time that you walked into Charlie's barn?
Well, besides the fact that I was shaking in my boots, I was nervous and scared and intimidated and everything else. You know, it was surreal to me, and you know, I got lucky enough that someone didn't show up that morning, and they threw me in a stall with four stake horses and said, groom these horses, and I stayed with Charlie for about, you know, 3 years, and I groomed horses like Palace Music, who is probably best known as the sire of Cigar, and had some other real quality horses when I was working over there for Charlie.
It's amazing that even trainers of Charlie Whittingham's caliber have employees that don't show up. You would think cherry job like that would be, everybody would want to be there.
Absolutely. But you know how it goes. He must have had a few too many that night, and just didn't, the alarm didn't work for him that day. And it was good luck for me, because I got the job that I really wanted.
Pete, I'm sure that there are little things that you've taken from each person that you've worked with along the way that you still incorporate into your training methods today. Talk about some of those things that you learned from those people along the way.
Well, you're right. You know, you learn different things, because everyone does things a little bit differently. They feed a little different. They train a little different. And, you know, when I worked for Dude, for example, we had a lot of claimers and cheaper horses, and you know, Jude taught me that, you know, you didn't have to necessarily gallop them all, you know, 2 miles a day to get them fit or keep them fit. And so we, you know, I learned that, you know, you can sometimes just jog a horse and keep them fresh, and they'll run as well or better than they would if you, you know, galloped them a mile and a half. You know, Charlie was big on schooling horses. You know, we'd school them, and we'd go out in big sets, and we'd walk them around for 10-15 minutes before they'd ever even go to the track, and kind of more the European style of training. And I still incorporate that. I take my horses out in sets of 5 and 6, and we do a lot of walking with them before and after, and you know, we school them quite a bit. And, you know, so, you know, with every trainer, you know, you just kind of, you know, some things resonate with you and stick, and other things you pass on.
Well, certainly, you know, you mentioned Joe Manzi. Joe, unfortunately, passed away in his sleep at Hollywood Park one afternoon, but he was an outstanding trainer, won countless stakes races, and he was a guy that also worked for Charlie Whittingham.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. No, Joe was a great trainer, and he had worked for Charlie and had ridden races and all the rest. And Joe was a really, really super trainer, trained a horse named Roving Boy. That was a top 3-year-old of his year, and a lot of other top quality horses.
Pete, just curious, with that rider's background, do you still get on some of your horses in the morning?
I do. I get on some here and there, and if I'm not on a racehorse, I'm on the pony. So, you know, I ride all morning long, which keeps me in decent shape, and I enjoy it. I like to get on horses. You know, you get a different perspective as a trainer that can gallop horses. A lot of times you can feel things that you can't see. So I think it does give me an advantage to be able to, you know, get on one and you know, feel what a rider may be saying that I can't see from my pony.
Have you ever dramatically adjusted something you were doing with a horse because you were aboard the horse in the morning and felt something that you thought, I could try this a little bit differently?
Absolutely. No, all the time. You know, you get on one and you know, you realize you've got the wrong equipment, you've got the wrong bit on him, or, you know, the horse is gawking at shadows, or he needs blinkers or a tongue tie. So all the time, that's kind of why I like to get on him, you know, to give that other sense of, you know, what the horse needs. You know, what are you feeling? What is he doing out there? Because, you know, a lot of times you're watching them train and, you know, you've got 4 or 5 or 6 of them on the track and you can't see everything. So, you know, when you get on them, you definitely, you know, get a feel for their personality and whether they need, you know, training adjustments or equipment adjustments.
Talk about when you first started out on your own, when it said Peter Miller next to the horse's name and the early part of your career.
Well, you know, that's, of course, the toughest time, you know, trying to get going. And you know, my dad, God rest his soul, was my first client. And we claimed a horse at Del Mar. Horse name's Zar Moro. And he won for 10. And I remember we double jumped him to 16 and he ran second and we lost him. And I was back out of business. But, it was a lot of work because at that time I did everything. You know, I groomed them, I walked them, I rode them. And so, you know, to have three or four horses and do everything yourself is an all day endeavor. But I wouldn't have traded the experience for anything. You know, it really, you know, helped me form, you know, the person and the horseman that I am now.
You know, Pete Miller, by the way, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Pete, when we were in California for the Santa Anita Derby, there was a race named in honor of your dad, Gary, that was the last race on the card that day, and you won that race. Had to be pretty special, I'd imagine.
That was, you know, honestly, it was a race named in honor of my stepfather, Gary Hallman, who passed away a couple weeks ago. And who helped raise me, and it was really special. It was more special, I think, than even if I'd have won one of the bigger races on the card that day. It was an amazing win, and we had the memorial service for him in the turf club after that race, and we all put our right hands in the air because that's what my dad used to do in the winner's circle after a win. Every race he'd have his right hand with his fist pumped in the air. And my horse just got up in the last jump, and I know it was Gary that was pushing him to the wire.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. And I remember the first time I won a race for your dad and I saw him do the fist pump thing, I thought, oh man, he's really excited about winning this race. And then I saw him win one with Mike Mitchell and he did the same thing.
Yeah.
I thought it was all for me, but it wasn't. That was his custom.
That was his thing. Yeah, that was his thing. But it was fun. It was fun. So you know, and Jude was there and it was great seeing Jude, and you know, brought back a lot of memories.
We had lots of great summers down at Del Mar. Our families are very close, have been for ever since we met. I don't even know what year it was, but it's been a long, long time now. And I'm always, you know, proud to watch your horses run. You do a fantastic job.
Well, thank you very much. And I appreciate that you gave me the opportunity, and, you know, you taught me a lot. You know, you were really, you know, kicking butt at the time, and we're always, you know, up on the leading trainer standings at the time down here, and I learned a lot working for you.
Pete, you kind of made a custom here of kind of nail-biting finishes. You mentioned getting up in the last jump to win that race named in honor of Gary, and then last year at Del Mar, you won the training title over Bob Baffert by winning three races on closing day. So you came from the back of the pack to win that one a little bit and got up in the final jump. And coming to the top, your top horse right now, he's kind of done the same thing for you and had some thrilling finishes. You're making a habit of that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think it's shortening my life, but you know, and I'd like to blame it on my hair loss, but I think it's genetics. But no, it's been an exciting go of late, and you know, that Del Mar title was tremendous, winning the last three races on closing day after I had gone like 0-30 in the two weeks prior. You know, it was really exciting.
What separates Pete Miller as a trainer from other guys? I know my brother Mark loves having horses with you, and what is that he's not the easiest guy in the world to train for, by the way. What is that separates Pete Miller from another trainer?
Well, you know, I think I'm extremely hands-on, and a lot of guys are not. And I think that's the main thing for me is, you know, I mean, it, you know, it's 12 o'clock on Tuesday, and I'm here in my barn at Hollywood Park, and you know, and I'm a barn rat. You know, I love it. You know, it's nowhere I'd rather be than at the barn. So, and a lot of guys, you know, they like the races more than they like the backside. So it's just a different kind of mentality where I really enjoy, you know, being with the guys, working with the horses. I like to touch every horse every day. I like to watch them all train. And, you know, I think that's really, for me, has been the difference, because I think when you feel and touch a horse every day and watch them train every day, that's when you get the little cues from them. Okay, we should be doing this with them, or we should be doing that with them, or you catch an injury before it happens. You know, so I think for me, that's really what I've, you know, kind of built my career on is just being really hands-on and doing a lot of the work myself. And, you know, I'm not going to change it.
Pete, it's interesting to hear you use that term to describe yourself. You said you're a barn rat, and this is where you love to be. That seems to be a recurring theme with so many of the trainers that we've had on the show, at least the ones that are at the top. That's all they know. This is their life. And I'll ask them about their habits and different things, hobbies that they'll do outside of racing. And most of them will tell you that they don't really have time. They're just so focused on what they do at the racetrack. Are you the same way?
Absolutely. It's all encompassing. And I'm fortunate to have a beautiful wife, Lonnie, that's understanding and also loves the game. Because otherwise it can't work. You know, I mean, it's a 24/7 job. You know, I'm you know, either thinking about horses or talking about horses most all the day, and, you know, fielding phone calls from owners and agents and things of that nature. You know, and it's what I love to do. So it's not, you know, it's not work. It's a labor of love.
Yeah, it's really a lifestyle. And talk about your wife and how nice it is that she loves the game and enjoys it.
Well, you know, my wife, she's the greatest. Her name's Lonnie, and we've been together about 8 years, and we have a 10-month-old son, Jacob. And, you know, we met through the horses. She was working, running an owner's a business, and we met down at San Luis Rey. And you know, it you need that, you know, you need that support. And she without her, I couldn't do what I do. I couldn't work and get on horses and be around the barn. She frees all that up, all the paperwork, all the billing, all the BS, so to speak, that I hate to do, she does. And, you know, without her, I wouldn't be where I am right now.
Well, and you mentioned your young son, 10 months old, Jacob. Has he been around the barn much? Does he like the horses?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he does. He likes the horses, and he's been in a lot of pictures. And, sometimes I scare him when I'm rooting for a horse down the stretch. He might get a little spooked, but no, he comes by it naturally. But my wife says no trainer there. He's going to be an owner.
I was going to ask you if you would encourage him to follow in your footsteps.
You know, it's a really tough life. It really is. And you know, it's not something that I would necessarily recommend for anyone. I think, as Jude said, it's a lifestyle and a labor of love, and it's either in your blood or it's not. But no, there are definitely easier ways to make a living.
Pete Miller, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Pete, let's talk about some of the outstanding horses you've had an opportunity to be around throughout your career. You mentioned the great ones when you were with Charlie Whittingham, and of course you've had your fair share of really top quality runners. Talk about some of those horses that really stand out to you.
Well, you know, my best horse over the past few years has been Common to the Top, and he's just just an amazing horse. You know, he's a millionaire. And, you know, we bought him for $22,000 at OBS, and, he's just, just an iron horse. So he's my all-time favorite. But we've had, you know, some other horses. Set Play won the Grade One Del Mar Debutant a few years back for us, and I've got a pretty nice grass horse named All Squared Away that won the Lexington last year. And you know, believe it or not, I gave $1,000 for him at Fasm Tipton. But you know, we've been fortunate to have some nice horses and you know, not have to pay a top dollar to get them.
Talk about that a little bit, going to the sales and finding these horses, because I know you do that yourself as well. You have a great eye for a horse, and you've really managed to snag some awful nice horses for not much money.
Well, thank you. I love the sales, you know, and I really enjoy going to the sales and looking at all the horses and the videos. I prefer the two-year-old sales to the yearling sales. I just think you get a lot more value without having to have risked, you know, the 6 months of breaking and training and all the rest. You know, we work the sales hard. I've got a couple guys that help me down in Ocala, some local guys. Ramey Leitner and Chad Johnson have been helping me for the past, you know, 4 or 5 years. You know, it's worked out really good. We've had a lot of success buying out of the two-year-old sale.
And of course, that all-star comment to the top, 22,000. I didn't know that, Pete. That's amazing. And the success that he's had, now earning well in excess of $1 million. I think his career earnings are now somewhere around almost 1.2 million. But he took you to the holy grail of horse racing in the first Saturday in May at Churchill Downs. Talk about that experience and going down that road with coming to the top.
Well, that was amazing. You know, we ran second, got beat ahead in the Santa Anita Derby, and we took a shot. We kind of thought that he wasn't a mile and a quarter horse, but we thought, you know, hey, we're in, the horse is doing well, let's take a chance. And, you know, he led to the quarter pole and, you know, unfortunately came out of the race with a chipped ankle, and we took the chip out and gave him plenty of time, and luckily he's come back firing as an older horse.
Yeah, he was very impressive in New York, coming back on 7 days rest. I really loved that maneuver, and I know you took some guff, I will say, from some people about it. Talk about that experience.
Well, that was, you know, kind of gut wrenching, you know, making that move. Gary Barber, the part owner in Comet of the Top, along with Kevin Tsujihara and Roger Birnbaum, you know, they're all Hollywood execs. And, you know, Gary said, hey, if the horse is okay, do you want to put him on a plane and go? And I said, you know, if the horse is okay, I'm okay. I said, we're going to take a lot of crap, especially if we get beat. But you know, we're big boys, and we were ready for it. And fortunately, the horse ran to expectations and won the race. And it was just a tremendous, tremendous feeling.
Pete, I've always been somewhat envious of trainers and owners that have the opportunity on that first Saturday in May to make the walk from the barn area around over to the paddock before the race. It's got to be one of the greatest walks in all of sports. Look back on that moment and talk about making that walk over with Comet to the Top.
Well, yeah, you're right about that. I mean, it was a thrill of a lifetime. You know, I get goosebumps just thinking about it now. And, you know, I hope to be back there someday and, you know, hopefully with a horse with a real chance, you know, to win. But it was a moment that you just never will forget. And, you know, it was just tremendous to walk with the horse, with the owners, and see the crowd and all the excitement was really surreal.
You know, I asked Doug O'Neill this question when he was on the show. Does it make you want to get back there even more now that you've kind of been to the top, so to speak?
You know, yes and no. I want to get back there, but I think the first time you just want to get there. The second time I want to win, you know, and so I don't want to just try and go, you know, I just think, you know, it's to the detriment of your horse if you're just going, 'cause you can, Unless you have a real chance to win the race, I think you're doing the horse a disservice and your owner. But well, the owner, understandably, that's all for dreams is set there. So, you know, you have to keep that in mind as well. But moving forward, now that I've been there, I want to go there with a real chance to win it.
Trainer Pete Miller, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Pete, hard to believe it's been a half an hour already, but it has. Time flies, and it's been a great visit with you. Certainly enjoyed hearing your story, and want to wish you all the best with Comma to the Top and all of your other horses moving forward.
Well, thank you both very much for having me, and I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Pete.
Thanks, Pete.
All right, dude. Take care.
All right, Pete Miller, our special guest here on Trainer Talk. Fun visit.
Yeah, he's a good guy, and his family's great, and they have a long history in Southern California racing. Had a great role. His stepfather, Gary, had an amazing stable for many, many years, claiming stable. Actually, I think the first race I won for him, though, I actually bought a horse at a sale.
Oh, did you really?
It's kind of, yeah. Briar Lady was her name, and yeah, I bought her at a two-year-old sale, so that was a unique experience for both of us.
Yeah, it just goes to show you don't have to spend $1 million at the sales to get a horse that can get you to the Kentucky Derby.
Yeah, no, Pete does a great job buying horses. I mean, doesn't spend much money, and they run like trained pigs.
All right, second half of Trainer Talk coming up next here on HRRN. Don't forget, you can see our entire broadcast schedule, our entire Derby Week schedule at horseracingradio.net. Make sure you check that out, as we are your exclusive home for Kentucky Derby 139. The only place you'll hear it on radio, coast to coast and worldwide, is with us. We're back with the second half of Trainer Talk right after this on HRRN. Stay tuned.
Talk, presented by Bullet Train on HRRN. Bullet Train, it's time to get on board.
Group winning Bullet Train, the sensational three-quarter brother to the amazing racehorse Frankel, has captured the hearts and dreams of everyone who's seen him. Handsome and correct, he was precocious enough to win his debut at two with a massive 113 time form rating. Bullet Train had the speed American breeders seek and the class to defeat 11 horses who won or placed in a group one. And his pedigree, well, being bred by Judmont Farm, says it all. This year, Bullet Train joins Montjoux and Galileo as top sons of Sadler's Wells at stud. He stands at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky, for a $7,500 stud fee. For more information, call Sean Feld at 859-519-9665. Bullet Train has arrived at the station. It's time to get on board.
Attention horse owners, is your thoroughbred or standardbred trainer getting the most out of your investment? All natural EPO equine could be the answer. EPO equine is the most potent blood builder on the market. Top trainers like Scott Lake and Steve Margolis are reporting dramatic improvements in their horses. Easy to use and clinically tested, EPO equine is the product your horses need for speed, strength, and stamina right out of the gate. Call 215-501-6880 or visit epoequine.com.
RaceHorseReport.com.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RaceHorseReport.com. Make RaceHorseReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RaceHorseReport.com.
How would you like to make a free $50,000 win wager on this year's Preakness Stakes? Duh, of course you would. First, you'll need to become the grand prize winner of the $50,000 Express Bet Preakness Big Bet promotion. Then it's off to Baltimore. Top prize includes a trip for two to the Preakness, accommodations and tickets to the main event, so you'll be trackside to root your horse and money home. Express Bet's Preakness Big Bet is effortless to play. Earn one entry for each wager you make with Express Bet between now and May 4th, Kentucky Derby Day. The more wagers you make, the more chances you have to win. Runner-up prize prizes include $50, $100 ExpressBet wagering credits. And remember, with ExpressBet's Bet and Get, new account holders can earn up to $125 in wagering credit immediately. Visit ExpressBet.com today for complete Big Bet details to register for the promotion and to open a new no-fee wagering account.
Account wagering is not permitted in all states. National Problem Gambling Support Line, 1-800-522-4700.
Hi, this is Joel Rosario.
Hi, this is Jockey John Court.
Hi, this is Calvin Burrow. You're listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Second half of Trainer Talk presented by Bullet Train here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Enjoyed our visit with trainer Pete Miller in the first half of the show. Always fun to catch up with Pete and hear his stories and his background. And now turning our attention to the native of Ireland. It is David Carroll, our guest here in the second half of the show. He has saddled 418 winners throughout his career. They have earned more than $15 million, and he is nice enough to take the time to be with us here this afternoon. David, thanks for joining us.
Mike, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, happy to have you on board, and looking forward to hearing your story. I caught up with you yesterday, and you were picking your son up from golf practice, apparently a few athletes in the family.
Well, I hope he can turn to be a big, good golfer and maybe make some money at it. But he loves, he's 13 and 7th grade, and I think it's a great hobby or sport to pick up and something he can do for a long time.
The next Rory McIlroy?
In my dreams. then I really could have some fun at the September sales.
That's right. A few nice horses for Dad, right?
Yeah. I could spend his money for a change.
I think that's what Tom Proctor's rooting for with his daughter. She's a pretty good golfer.
Yes, Heather is a very good golfer, and she's actually traveled the country, and I've seen her play a little bit, and she's certainly good. And Tom's not a bad golfer himself.
Does your son have a golfer that he looks up to, like a Rory McIlroy or somebody along those lines?
No, he's a Ricky Fowler fan because of his attire. He loves all that hat with the brim, the colorful clothes, and I said, Declan, he has the game to match the clothes. Now you have to have the game to match the clothes as well, otherwise people will laugh at you. He thinks it's all about looking good. Ricky Fowler would be his hero, but. I love watching golf. I don't get to play much golf because it's obviously very time-consuming. But in the summertime and the evening time, it's something father and son can do, and it's something we could do hopefully for a long time.
That's great. Better Ricky Fowler than the guy with the crazy pants there.
Ian Poulter.
Ian Poulter, yeah, he's got some wild looking clothes, and John Daly too.
John Daly can light it up too.
He's really got some bright pants.
Oh my God, they're very, that's what we call loud. But John Daly is loud, and those clothes are even louder. And these days, it's all about the fashion and how you look. And Ricky Fowler is a good young man. I think he's out. A good road model as well, and it's something he's just taken up, and he seems to enjoy it. So, when you're 13, his attention span is not very long. So we'll see how it goes.
Well, David, as I mentioned, you were born and raised in Ireland, and not hard to get into horse racing when you're living in Ireland and growing up around it. They're obviously a very popular sport. Talk about you and how you got started in the game, and how you got hooked on horse racing.
Oh, I was hooked on racing from the very get-go. My father was a very successful steeplechase jockey. We have some land at home with stables. We always had lay-ups, so to speak. We had a few mares of our own. My mother had a shop, a country store, and so she ran the store. And then my father was a jockey, had the stables, and from a very early age, I have two older brothers and two younger sisters, so the three of us, the boys, the sisters, never really got into the horses, except from a social point of view of going to the races. But we were always around the horses, helping clean the stalls before we go to school, riding the ponies, and we wanted to be like our father. And he was a great teacher. He was, you know, he was a tough man in the sense that, you know, we had to get up early, do our chores, off to school, come home from school, ride out, groom. Everything had to be done to perfection, but we loved every second of it, and it's all we wanted to do. You know, we saw him work extremely hard. We saw him take some unbelievable falls, broken bones. You know, all the work that goes into that. And then my eldest brother Raymond, he followed him into his footsteps, and he was champion jockey. He was stable jockey to John Oxford a long time, you know, world winners all over the world. And so he was my idol then, because he's your older brother. And, you know, my other brother, Frankie, he also rode, but he was like me. He was good in the morning, not so good in the afternoon. Something happened when I put the white pants on. So I looked good in the morning time, but there was also a lot of pressure because our family, you know, we had a great name in the business. And it's just like, you know, doesn't mean Tiger Woods can play golf. It's just, you know, I loved this. It's all I wanted to do. And then, but I just didn't have what it took to be a jockey. And so I was smart enough not to, you know, to stop when I did. And, but no, horses were, it's all we do. We live and breathe with horses, and I still do to this day.
I remember the first time I met you, David, was over at the old 505 farm, and you came out to get on a horse that one of your clients owned. And I remember walking to the track behind you and thinking to myself, man, this guy looks good on a horse. And then you gallop that horse around there so easy. And I go, where the heck has this guy been?
well, there you go, dude, because you just, yeah, I mean, I was obviously taught very well, and growing up in Ireland, it's just such horse country. And then, you know, served my apprenticeship, and the standard is so high. And then I worked 6 years for John Ox, and then I ended up doing the course in the Irish National Stud. So I obviously had a great opportunity, had a great background, and but I wasn't going to be a jockey. So I have a great appreciation for our jockeys, and you know, but I also, you know, so those guys are a special talent. They really are.
Well, they are. And that one comment that you made, David, one thing that always strikes me about riders is that, you know, they have all kinds of courage. They'll go down, they'll be injured, they'll get right back up. And, you know, maybe a day, 2 days, even a week or two later, they're back on the horse and doing it all over again. You talked about watching your dad have several spills and broken bones, but then you said, that's all we ever wanted to do was be like him. It's an amazing mentality, and amazing that didn't deter you, that you still wanted to do it.
No, but I was smart enough, Mike, that my father was a steeplechase jockey, and I said I wanted to be a jockey, but not a steeplechase jockey. they're a completely different breed. They're absolutely nuts. and I follow racing every day in Ireland and in Europe. I keep up what's going on, and I love the jumping, and with Cheltenham just gone by, I watched every race every day. I try to keep on track, but, you know, watching it firsthand, just the falls, the pains, the broken bones that he endured, I said, you know, that was something, my pain threshold wasn't that high, but, you know, obviously I have broken bones from riding, but it's something that you just want to get up and do. It's an unbelievable sport that we were in right now, and I love I love the training part of it and the exercising part of it, and the politics part of it is I don't enjoy so much, because I think our game can be much maligned, and by perception of people that don't know what goes on back here, the people that put the work in and the hours spent and the love that people give these horses and the love back horses give, and that's what I like about it, you know.
Well, that's the passion of the game that you embrace, and so many of our guests here on Trainer Talk. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I enjoy doing these shows so much, is to to allow people a glimpse of that and to see how much the horses mean to the people that work with them every day. I think a lot of times people think, you know, trainers are just in it for the money, and most trainers don't even make any money. They might be able to eke out a living, but they don't get rich doing it. They do it because they love the animals so much.
No, most certainly. We're not in the game to get rich, and is there, you know, if we were to get paid by the hour, we'd all be millionaires, but we're there's nothing else I would rather do. It's just seeing getting the horse in, developing a horse, getting the best out of a horse, whether it's made in 10, made in 15. And the only thing I ask the horse is to give me everything you have. And when they go out there and win whatever race it is, you know, it's such a proud feeling. And the purse may be small, the purse may be large. It's just that tremendous feeling of accomplishment that the horse went out there and gave you 110%. And that's something, you know, every day. Yeah, every day we ask these horses to, you know, to go out there and give it to us. So it's up to us, and it's our responsibility to take care of these horses and to give them everything we possibly can and protect them. And when things are not going well or not feeling well or they need time. And but we have a huge responsibility as owners and trainers to protect these horses. So when I read things that we read about every day, it just saddens me. And I wish those people that would say those things would spend the day in anybody's barn and just see the horses and the care from the hot walkers, the grooms, the trainers, you know, the care these horses, give these horses. I mean, I love the sport so much that anytime I read something negative about it, it just it really saddens me.
David Carroll, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on the Horse Racing Radio Network. David, when did you come to the United States, and what led you to make that decision?
Well, you know, I went down when I had a jockey's license for 3 years. I probably should just had a. I should have had it for about 6 months, but I stretched it out, because I just wasn't getting any better, to be honest. And I wasn't getting any many opportunities, but you know, went down that path. I was getting too heavy to ride in the flat. I wasn't going to go over the National Hunt, and you kind of reach crossroads where you're just going to keep working as a stable lad. The opportunities in Ireland are so few. It's not like over in America here where you just get a horse, you get a stall, and off you go. You have to have land, you have to have stables. There's just so much goes into it that there's very few opportunities. I did the course in the Irish National Stud then, and having completed that course, I was afforded the opportunity to come over and be a student exchange with TaylorMade Farm. And that kind of gave me a whole... So I came over to Lexington, and I stayed a year with TaylorMade Farm, and I learned so much. You know, the Taylors are wonderful people, great teachers. You work hard. You know, Christophe Clement was there with me at the time. Mark Bergerac, who's now one of the leading bloodstock agents in France, was there at the time. So many really good people went through that time. And, you know, it was, you know, once I got over, we worked with the yearling, did the sales, the prepping. There was a whole new side of it to me, and I just enjoyed that part of it. But once the year was up, you know, I wanted to get to the racetrack, and once I got on the racetrack, then there was no getting me off the racetrack. but I'll tell you a funny story. We're at Christoph and I, we rode the van up from Lexington to Saratoga with the yearling. So we got up there, and so we got the horses settled in, and Christoph said to me, David, I am going over to see Shug McGeaney. I'm going to look for him after this sale. And I said, Shug who? And Shug McGeaney, the one of the leading trainers. And having been new to America, I'd never heard of Shug, never heard of the Fibs, and that showed you my ignorance of American racing at the time. And when I looked through the program, I saw Leo O'Brien. And I said, wow, I wonder if there's any relation to Michael O'Brien, who I knew in Ireland. So I was more interested in going to see Leo O'Brien than going to see Shug. So, and, you know, it was kind of, I went to the races for the first time that day. I'll never forget it. Made his secret one with me. And it was raining, I believe. And when hooked up with Leo, just said hello, introduced myself, which is good. Never did go to see Shug. And it was funny the way things worked out. Christoph went to work for Shug. I stayed at TaylorMade Farm a little bit longer. I ended up going to work for Shug for 6 wonderful years. And it's funny what life throws at you and how things work out. And this is an unbelievable country. It affords you unbelievable opportunities. And no matter where you're from, and that's the greatest thing about this country, people don't discriminate where you're from. If you work hard, you're given an opportunity and make the most of it, there's no stopping anybody. And you can't say that about any other country in the world.
Well, it's amazing that you two guys ended up, you know, working together at TaylorMade and then for Shug, and have both gone on to have tremendously successful careers. I mean, that's the tribute to Shug as a teacher, but it's also a tribute to you guys who came here kind of cold turkey and started out from scratch.
Yeah, I had no training in Europe. It was obviously different at the time. I wanted to be jockey. And I wish at the time, when I worked for John Ox, who's such a number one and gentleman, number two, such a tremendous trainer, I'd wished I'd paid more attention to the training side of it. Because you're caught up in being a jockey and you jump off and you go. But when I came over here to America, it was like when I spent those years with Chug, I just learned so much. And you learn through osmosis. He's not one to pull you aside and doing this and doing that. You just watch and you watch and you learn. He had just wonderful horses, you know, from 85 through 90. There was unbelievable amount of talent in the barn. I think at one particular time we had 12 grade one winners in the barn, from Personal Ensign, Seeking the Goal, Easy Goal, and Rhythm, and Adjudicating My Big Boy, and Fast Play, you know, Personal Flag. You know, it just went on. It was just a phenomenal time, and it was just weekend after weekend after weekend. You know, so when the time came for me to finish up, I finished up in 90 with Rhythm, and he won the Travers that year, and then he went through the Classic. But it was. I spent 6 years. I cannot felt the urge that I want to go train, but it's very hard to move up in Shug's operation. Like, nobody ever leaves. Buzzy, who's the assistant, is still an assistant to this day. And it just tells you how loyal people are to Shug and what a great man he is to work for. But I felt the urge to leave, to learn more. And I actually went to Billy Mott to ask him for a job because I was such a great fan of Billy Mott. And he, at the time, had just hired Ralph Nix to be his assistant. But he recommended a trainer in Kentucky, Pete Vestal, for me to go. He said, Pete's the next up-and-coming big trainer in Kentucky. And they ended up, I never heard of Pete, to be honest, at the time, because I was so, you know, when you're up in New York, you just kind of think anybody else in New York can't train a horse. Once I got to know Pete and spent 2 years with him around lesser type horses, we still have some good horses, but I learned so much from Pete Vestal as well, around lesser horses, how to maintain horses, horses' legs, getting the best out of cheaper type horses. And so between Shug and Pete Vestal, when it came time to go on my own, I knew what it was like to ride a good horse. I knew what it was like to be around a good horse, but I also knew what it was like to have a cheaper horse to be putting breeze every week, or how to manage horses that, you know, were not to, you know, grade one, grade two standard, and how to evaluate horses. And still a learning process, because you learn something every day. Horses teach you every day, and you make mistakes along the way. But I just had a wonderful, wonderful education, and it's been so much. I'm so blessed to have horses and clients to train for. And every day I get up and go to work. And it's just every day is a new day. It really is. And that's the wonderful thing about our game.
David, you obviously have a tremendous amount of respect for those people that helped you along the way, and for those people that you now compete with, so to speak, in the trainer ranks, your peers, the likes of Bill Mott and Shug McGahey. I can imagine, and I want you to talk about this, the feeling that you had the first time that you saddled a horse and you're in there with those individuals in the starting gate, and then the first time that you beat them, that had to be an amazing feeling.
Most certainly was. And I started off in December of 93, in training. My first runner was at Calder, and I was in a stake race, and Angel Pennant Jr. Beat me, and Johnny Velasquez rode his horse, and Mark Goody rode mine. And it was just a tremendous sense of accomplishment. And the filly I ran was a name. Her name was Marcia's River, who to this day has a race named after her at Gulfstream Park. And she turned out to be really good. We won some Grade Twos and Grade Threes with her, and so I was lucky to have a nice. And I inherited her off Pete Bestel, because Pete wouldn't go to Gulfstream or the Florida in the wintertime. He'd go to Oak Lawn and choose strictly turf. And he was kind enough to get me her from Mr. Jim Gottwald. And it was just a great way to start off training with a very nice filly who turned out to be a very good mare. And the first time when you compete against those guys, you walk in, you're like, I don't really, do you belong here? You're intimidated. And then you quickly realize, no matter how good these guys are, which they're the best in the business, it comes out, it's horse racing too. And so if you have the horse and you prepare the horse the best of your ability, you go in there with more confidence, obviously. But those guys are the best in the business, no doubt about it. They've been doing it an awful long time. I watch them how develop horses. That's the fun part. You watch them develop horses, and you know, when you look and you learn, because if you have a horse that you think is along those lines, kind of see what do they do. You know, obviously I got to make decisions now, but you know, they're still never too old to learn or to observe. The wonderful thing about Shug was during that time, you know, he was blessed to train for Claiborne and the Fibs, obviously. And when horses needed time, they got time. There was never such thing as forcing a race, forcing a horse. And that's a wonderful, and Shug will tell you this to this day, it's just a wonderful privilege to have. You know, a new breed of owner right now is not quite so understanding. We have the sheets, we have the staff, we have so much information out there. But I tell owners that I'm just a messenger, and I'll tell you how the horse is doing. This is what I'm seeing. This is what I think we should do. But I'm basically talking for the horse. And, you know, I'm very lucky right now to have owners that will listen. And occasionally, you know, certain owners want to push but Billy Mott, the same position right now, and horses need time to get time. And it's just wonderful to see these guys in action. It really is. And see these horses run consistent races. You know, you never see their horses in and out of form, and it's great. But I never feel intimidated now. I'm in a race with them, and I think I have the horse. You know, I don't worry about them. I just worry about my horse running this race. And you know, that's the way I have to be right now.
You pulled off a tremendous training feat at the beginning of Keeneland with a horse named Poliziano. Is that his name?
Poliziano, yes.
Yeah.
He was a horse that he's obviously beautifully bred, smart strike. He had a substantial injury, and he'd been off quite a long time when we got him. And Mr. Adam and Ernie Remedosa, his farm manager at Codeland Farm, have been very kind to me to give me an opportunity to train some of these horses. And the only thing to tell me is the horses had time off. Just take your time with the horse. We're not going to tell you where to run. And then you run the horse where you feel he's got his best chance of winning. And that's just unbelievable opportunity to have, that they're not rushing. They're not saying there's a race at Keeneland on this day. Can you get them ready for that? I like to get the horse ready and then pick out a race. And, that way you're going over to run that horse on the horse's terms, and not just because there's a race in the book. I never feel that works out. So he was off a long time, but I was given a lot of time to prepare him. And we put him in the right spot. And when you put them in the right spot and they got some talent, then they make you look good. But it's all about the horse. And he did run it. Anytime you win a race at Keeneland, it's special. I don't care what kind of race.
That's right. Well, yeah. He was off for years. Yeah, it wasn't like your standard, 6-month layoff. He was off for years. I've been going to the races for 53 years, and I hadn't seen a horse win off that long of a layoff. I don't think ever. It was really impressive, and I was really happy to see you pull that off.
Yeah, Well, you're very kind, and I'm so happy for Mr. Adam. This is my first winner for Mr. Adam and at Keeneland. And having said that, I think it's maybe my first winner for him at Keeneland. But no, they've given me some horses, and you have an opportunity to train for a farm like that and get horses like that. You want to make the most of your opportunities, and but the horse was certainly in the right spot, and you know, he was given a very nice ride by Edgar, and yeah, it was a good day, so we'll try and do it again tomorrow.
David, very few people ever have the opportunity to make it to the top of the mountain, so to speak, and to saddle a horse in the Kentucky Derby. You had that opportunity in 2008 with Dennis of Cork. He finished third, a tremendous race for him. Talk about that experience of being part of the greatest 2 minutes in sports.
It was a privilege. It's such a privilege to have a horse in the Kentucky Derby. And anyone that hasn't had an opportunity to walk over there with their horse for the Derby, it's something you want everyone to experience. I got to do it in 88 and 89. Carrying the Buckingham Sponge for Speaking the Gold, and then for Easy Goer as the exercise riders, and that was just a tremendous thrill. But it paled in comparison to having a horse that you train, that you develop, and that has earned a right to run in the race. And we felt that Dennis has certainly earned a right to run in the Derby. And that walk with my two kids, my wife unfortunately was in the hospital at the time awaiting gallbladder surgery, and she put that off. She was supposed to have it that day, and she put it off so that she could watch the Derby. So
wow.
That was the only thing that was missing from that very special day. But it was a tremendous thrill. Finished third, obviously Big Brown won easy, and the only thing that spoiled the whole day, obviously, was the tragic death of Eight Bells. But it was a feeling of euphoria. I couldn't even imagine winning the race, because if it feels any better than that, then it's just an unbelievable. But hopefully I'll have an opportunity to make it back. And but it's a Kentucky Derby is a special race, and I hope to get to experience it again.
Well, David, just about out of time here. Hard to believe this has really flown by. It's been a fun visit with you, and we really appreciate you sharing your story with us. And you can hear it in your voice. You wake up every morning and you just pinch yourself for being part of this game.
No doubt about it. And it's the greatest game in the world. It really is. And we just need to focus on the positive in this game and not dwell on the politics of it. But I'm blessed to have some great trainers to train for. I get to come to work and do not work. I get to come and spend time with horses every single day, and I couldn't ask for more. But I'd like to, I want racing to be focused in the highlights, and get young people back in the game again and to enjoy it for what it is, the horses. It's all about the horses. It really is.
Trainer David Carroll, the native of Ireland, now living in Louisville, Kentucky. David, we really appreciate it. Looking forward to catching up with you at Keeneland and, of course, over at Churchill Downs.
Look forward to it. Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Thanks so much.
Yes. Bye-bye.
Wow, so much fun. David Carroll, great, great story. Great interview.
Another trainer we could have, if you do say so yourself.
No, he was outstanding, yeah. Right, yeah. No, I asked brilliant questions. But
I know. Another guy great. We could have spent an hour with.
Yeah, easily.
We may need to switch these to 1 hour. Of course, when we do that, we'll have somebody giving us one-word answers, and we'll be, ready to. But, great story. We basically only scratched the surface. I would have loved to talk to him about John Ox a little bit more. John Ox provided me with my favorite horse that I ever trained, a horse that some of his lady relatives bred. So
really?
It was Freya Stark was her name, and she was my favorite that I ever trained, and a very talented filly. But she came from a steeplechase family as well, just like David Carroll.
Yeah. Well, Pete Miller in the first half of the show, David Carroll in the second half. If you missed any portion of this Trainer Talk edition, you can go back and listen to the show on podcast on our website, horseracingradio.net. It will be up there later on tomorrow. And, of course, you can also catch iTunes, Horse Racing Radio Network. Look for us on there and listen to us on iTunes. We are back Thursday afternoon, 3 to 7 Eastern Time. Our Bristnet.com call-in show is the Final Furlong Show from 6 to 7 Eastern. Don't miss that. It's all presented by Twin Spires. And then, of course, this weekend, very busy for us. We'll be at Charlestown, West Virginia, the $1.5 million Charlestown Classic coming your way Thursday night from 9 to 11. And prior to that, the Coolmore Lexington from Keeneland from 4:30 to 5:30. Equine Forum live from Charlestown Saturday morning. So check that whole schedule out on our website, horseracingradio.net.
It's going to be a lot of fun. Looking forward to it.
For our producer, Lee Della Pina, Jude Feld, the Pontiff, I am Mike Penna. We will talk to you tomorrow here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
Good night, Barbados.